and welcome to the 10th and final episode of Let's Talk Shakespeare, a podcast brought to you from Stratford-upon-Avon by the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust. I'm Jennifer Reid, and today I'm asking, how did Shakespeare get so popular? Now, in previous episodes of this podcast, I've spoken to lots of different experts and practitioners to get to an answer. And in essence, that's what I'm doing today, except that the time we have is not nearly enough to cover such a huge subject. So instead, my clips today will be touching on lots of different reasons and theories about why Shakespeare became and remains so popular today, and we'll be jumping about a bit in the timeline again. So my first clip is from Michael Dobson, who's the director of the Shakespeare Institute, and he's going to tell us a bit about Shakespeare's fame during his own lifetime and introduce us to some of the ideas coming up in this episode.
Shakespeare got very popular in his own lifetime, and in fact, from very early in his own career, his narrative poem Venus and Adonis is about his most popular printed work right through his career. You know, as early as 1593, he had an overnight sensation with that poem, which everybody finds tremendously erotic, tremendously charming, tremendously classical. You know, there are many, many allusions to it. It's a bestseller. There's only one surviving copy of the first edition. It was read to death, possibly in some fairly unsalubrious ways, but the copy in the Bodleian Library, which is the one that survives, is at least clean. His plays, once they start getting into print, very soon start getting into print with his name on them. Henry IV, Part One goes through multiple editions in his lifetime and continues to stay in print as a paperback even after they all come out together in the folio in 1623. He is sufficient celebrity to have anecdotes told about him by 1599 or so. His plays are really good, and people recognise from the start that there's something very special about his talent. And the process, the kind of pyramid marketing process that Heming and Condell outline in the preface to the first folio, where they say, you know, if you like him, tell your friends to read him, you know, make sure they buy this book, you know, spread the word, has just continued to work ever since. There's such a range of stuff in the plays. The fact that they always have to be cut and adapted and slightly modified for performance, so that people always have to, and actors always have to contribute lots of themselves. They're sort of perpetual opportunities for other people to get in on the act and do new things with them. So, you know, as drama, they always happen in the present. It's not monumental stuff that goes out of fashion. It's stuff that is perpetually asking to be regenerated and translated and spread. He's already well known, or at least some of the plays were already well known in continental Europe before he dies. You know, we know that Hamlet, Merchant of Venice are being taken on tour and adapted into German around the Baltic states while Shakespeare is still around. And they're soon, you know, anywhere the English language goes, Shakespeare goes too. And he's already, you know, there's a an Italian book from the 1680s that's a book encouraging Italians to learn English, and it says the main reason you really would bother to learn English is their thundering tragedies, you know, that you'd only bother to learn English in the 17th century for the sake of the theatre, because the theatre's so good. You know, London is famously a theatre capital while Shakespeare's working there. You know, we've got Thomas Platter coming from Switzerland and commenting on seeing Julius Caesar, and Arnold von Buchel from Holland, you know, describing they've still got these amazing Roman playhouses in London. Yeah, they're fabulous. Here's a picture of one. It's a tourist phenomenon from early. It's a touring phenomenon from early. These plays really are extraordinarily good in a sort of generative way. They adapt things themselves, and they ask to be adapted themselves into, you know, whatever medium may be lying about. They are sort of measurably popular. It would be really interesting to sort of do an animation of a map of the world and kind of start colouring it in wherever they've actually seen Henry IV Part One, or first adapted Merchant of Venice, which is one of the most popular plays. It's often the first play done in any given country and in any given amateur dramatic society. I mean, Shakespeare's folk art as well as high art. You know, people do it for themselves, whether you like it or not.
Apologies for the background noise in that clip. We had the window open from our recording as it was summertime. So Shakespeare was popular in his own lifetime, or rather his work was. And my next clip is from Elizabeth Dollymore, who's a learning manager at the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust, and she goes back to Shakespeare's popularity just after his death, and with the next generation through to the Victorians and the Romantic poets.
A lot of it can be attributed to his popularity during the Victorian era, but let's take a little back step and say, okay, so Shakespeare was popular amongst those who knew him and within the circle of the sort of people that would have been exposed to that in his own lifetime. He wouldn't have been a national celebrity because there wasn't much sort of communication between, you know, London and, say, Yorkshire. But he certainly was popular in his own lifetime for what he did. And as most popular people, there were people who liked him and there were people who didn't like him. So when we think about what happened next, there was a period in history where the theatres were closed and then reopened in round about 1660. And at that time, Shakespeare's plays were still being performed and were performed, although were frequently amended by the next generation, sometimes quite hugely. So there wasn't at that time any sense of reverence towards Shakespeare's plays. They were nice blueprints that you could start with if you wanted to add other characters, other scenes, alternate endings. That was absolutely fine and up for grabs, and you just did that. And that tradition carried on roughly to the Victorian period, really, where we start to see the beginning of what we might call bardolatry, or people kind of idolising Shakespeare. And there's a little bit of that with the Romantic poets. For instance, kind of Keats is said to have always carried a little portrait of Shakespeare when he went on holiday. And when he went on holiday, he said he never felt at home until he put up his little portrait of Shakespeare. In fact, there's a well-known portrait of Keats which has the portrait of Shakespeare in the background. So that's fairly bardolatrous. I'm not sure many people carry with them a little portrait of Shakespeare wherever they go. So that kind of reverence perhaps began with the Romantic poets and continued on into the Victorian era. By the middle to late Victorian era, we're beginning to see that reflect itself in the idea that stage performances ought to be reverent towards Shakespeare's original text and ought not to change too much from what was felt that Shakespeare wrote. Also, around about that kind of time during the Victorian period, it became something which was taught at school. And that, of course, immortalised it, really, because it got onto the curriculum and has stayed there pretty much ever since. So every person who goes through the education system in the UK is exposed to Shakespeare. Whether that makes him popular or the person people would most like to smack, I'm not really sure. But of course, that's a famous Blackadder skit where Blackadder goes back in time and gives Shakespeare a left hook and says, well, that's for all those schoolboys, you know, ever since. So to a degree, it's we should blame the Victorians for Shakespeare's current centrality, shall we say.
Let's talk there about the theatres closing in the 17th century. The mid-1600s were not a great time for theatres in England, and they were closed for 18 years following the outbreak of civil war in 1642. They were reopened following the restoration of the monarchy in 1660, and after this, taste changed, but Shakespeare remained popular, if a little changed. The next clip is from Paul Edmondson, who's the head of research and knowledge here at the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust, to talk about this and to introduce us to the idea of how Shakespeare travelled around the world.
Shakespeare was popular in his own lifetime. He's written about by other poets and literary critics of the day, always in terms of admiration. And this continues posthumously, very significantly, with the publication of the first folio, with lots of commendatory verses at the beginning of that, with the funerary bust in Holy Trinity Church, which compares him to Socrates, Virgil and Nestor, classical figures. It talks about him as a writer. It invites us to see all that he has written as living art. And it also talks about him as a poet of nature. It says, with whom quick nature died. So when Shakespeare dies, something of nature dies as well. So from the earliest point, Shakespeare is famous. And he continues to be famous in lots of ways through to the closing of the theatres in the mid-17th century, when Britain was momentarily a republic, because of his influence, which can be discerned through other playwrights who are wanting to evoke his greatness, his popularity through their own work. A small example, actually a major example, is his collaborator John Fletcher, who who writes the first sequel ever to a Shakespeare play with his play The Woman's Prize or The Tamer Tamed, which continues the story of the taming of the shrew. Such was his admiration for his friend and co-author. They worked together on The Two Noble Kinsmen, Cardenio, and Henry VIII, All Is True. Then the theatres close, and the Restoration comes about with Charles II in the 1660s, and theatre starts to become popular again. But the taste has changed. We've moved from the outdoor space to massive indoor spaces. And what happens then is that Shakespeare's work undergoes very significant renovation and adaptation for the taste of its time. So, for example, a very popular playwright, poet of the time, Nahum Tate, rewrites the ending of King Lear, adapts it significantly to give it a happy ending. And Tate's version holds the stage for about 150 years, which is extraordinary to think about now. Shakespeare builds in popularity in the middle of the 18th century. He becomes the playwright which is exported to the growing British Empire, and then, lo and behold, stays behind after the British Empire has, after a century and a half of British Empire, Shakespeare remains. He's become so kind of embedded in the culture there. He's been appropriated by the culture there. A very significant example of that is the United States of America. After the War of Independence, Shakespeare remains in the late 18th century and becomes a part of the cosmopolitan makeup of the United States of America. And we see that all over the British Empire territory, that Shakespeare is exported and that Shakespeare remains, which is one of the reasons why Shakespeare is world famous, because of the British Empire, and why he's much translated into other languages and much adapted by many different cultures. Germany had a special affection for Shakespeare, has always had that, I think. Some of Shakespeare's own actors went to perform in Germany in his lifetime. And it's Germany where the first translation of Shakespeare occurs in the middle of the 18th century. And such is the extent of Shakespeare's popularity that he becomes an honorary German national poet. And by the middle of the 19th century, he's there with Goethe and Schiller and Shakespeare, and a German Shakespeare. And it was a great translation by August Wilhelm von Schlegel and Ludwig Teck in the early 19th century that, as it were, turned Shakespeare into romantic German playwright-poet through their translation. It's still the most famous German translation, though, of course, Germany, like any country that translates Shakespeare, will often translate the play afresh each time it's performed. A director of the play might commission a new translation, so you're always hearing Shakespeare, encountering Shakespeare differently each time you go to the theatre in another language, which helps to explain also why he continues to be popular in other cultures, because he always seems like a modern playwright with new translations being lavished upon him.
Now, one event that really put Shakespeare up on his pedestal was David Garrick's Shakespeare Jubilee, staged in September 1769 in Stratford-upon-Avon. It not only had an effect on bardolatry, but also for the first time really shone that spotlight on Stratford as the birthplace of the great national poet. So back to Paul to introduce the Garrick Jubilee for us.
A really important moment in the 18th century for the popularity of Shakespeare came with the great actor David Garrick, who in 1769 was invited by the corporation, the borough of Stratford-upon-Avon, to hold a special celebration of Shakespeare in Stratford-upon-Avon, which he did in the form of a jubilee in that September. And it was the first time, really, that Shakespeare broke out of the playhouses and out of the libraries and onto the streets among the people. This was, as it were, a civic Shakespeare, and it really helped to encourage a general feeling of popularity for Shakespeare. In fact, one of the things that's sort of notorious about the Garrick Jubilee is not a word of Shakespeare was spoken. His fame was so kind of self-assured in the minds of those who were gathering to celebrate him that they were celebrating, as it were, the name, the reputation of Shakespeare already, rather than the work itself. And any allusion, any moment of Shakespeare that was referred to was through David Garrick's own adaptations of his work. There was a great ode spoken in a temporary theatre pavilion which Garrick had built, roughly on the site, well, on the site of the current Royal Shakespeare Theatre. And Garrick himself spoke the ode and was given the freedom of the town of Stratford. And Thomas Arne, who wrote Rule Britannia, wrote music for that ode. So it was a great national moment which took place in the town. And from then on, it really sort of sealed Stratford's fate to become a Shakespeare destination. And people were already visiting the house on Henley Street, Shakespeare's birthplace, prior to the Jubilee. But of course they did so much more afterwards. The Jubilee itself transferred to the West End of London and became a show in its own right, and very popular.
Now, although it isn't quite true that there was no tourist industry in Stratford prior to the Jubilee, like is often said, it certainly did the town no harm, and it was this increase in tourist interest that resulted in the eventual purchase and saving of Shakespeare's birthplace by the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust. My final clip from Paul today is about this purchase.
Descendants of Shakespeare's sister lived in part of the Henley Street house until the early part of the 19th century. Then it fell into further private ownership, and the whole site came up for auction in 1847. And there was a public feeling that monies could be raised in order to secure the memorial for Shakespeare through the Henley Street house. And monies were collected in Stratford and London via committees. The London committee included Charles Dickens among its members, and enough money was raised. Well, let's say enough money was raised for it to be accepted by the auctioneers in September 1847, and that meant that the house was effectively in public ownership, and a trust, what became the Birthplace Trust, started really with the purchase of the house. So it was a conservation purchase. It was self-consciously an effort to commemorate Shakespeare through, as it were, a living memorial, a house. Charles Dickens, for example, thought that, whereas he didn't really want to see a statue of Shakespeare, he did think a house was a good way of remembering a writer. And of course, Shakespeare's house is among the first, really, of writers' houses in Britain to commemorate the writer in this way. And of course, then follow lots of similar examples. For example, the Bronte Parsonage in the 1890s is in a way modelled on the example that, you know, you could visit a place and visit the house of a writer.
And of course, without the birthplace, we wouldn't have this podcast. So my next clip is from Ben Crystal, who's an actor, director and producer, who's a slightly different take on this question than my previous speakers about how Shakespeare's been turned from a playwright and man of the theatre into a legend and man of the millennium.
Why are we talking about Shakespeare today rather than someone else? It starts at the time. Before Shakespeare was Shakespeare, Marlowe was Shakespeare. And before Marlowe was Shakespeare, Lyly was Shakespeare. There was always someone at the top of the tree. And it was Marlowe who had the notion that if I give my characters poetry to speak is their dialogue, and a particular type of poetry with a particular type of rhythm that I mentioned earlier that has the same rhythm as spoken English, then they will sound normal and natural and at the same time heightened. And Shakespeare took that idea and ran with it and realized that if he bent and broke that rhythm every now and again, it would replicate the same sort of non-fluency that we have now, the stutterings and the hesitations and the pauses and the fast-paced dialogue that the Greeks, hundreds and thousands of years before, had called stichomythia, rapid dialogue in poetry and plays. And to sort of bridge it to now, the reason why he probably became popular then and then is popular now is because he didn't ever write what it was to be from Stratford-upon-Avon or Warwick or England. He wrote what it was to be human, whether it's being jealous of your best friend's girlfriend, or loving someone so much you want to kill them, or trying to understand what it is to be a king or a soldier or a strong woman in a patriarchal society. These are all things that we can relate to around the world: love and loss and yearning and hatred, jealousy and death. It's not like Pinter, where you have to have a bit of an understanding about what it is to rent a basement flat in Camden Town. the themes and the issues are universal. And Shakespeare became Shakespeare only relatively recently, 100 or so years after he died. Well, first of all, you've got the puritanical regime in the Civil War where no theatre was put on. Then in the 1660s onwards, you have Shakespeare's plays being rewritten with happy endings. Then about 100 years later, you have David Garrick, who started his Stratford Festival, and that's only really when Shakespeare started to become Shakespeare. And 15 years after that, such was the interest in Shakespeare, for the very first time, someone reordered the plays not by genre, as in tragedy, comedy, and history, but chronologically. They didn't really know the chronology of the plays and the order in which they were performed or written. We still don't really know fully the exact ordering of them. We've got a pretty good guess. And then as soon as you start to think about the order in which the plays are written, it's hard not to blend that into the arc of the man's life. And as soon as you try to drill down deeper into when those plays were written and what things were happening in Elizabethan London at the time, and the mirroring of or the references to the Irish skirmishes in Henry V and that kind of thing, which places it quite firmly in 1599, and the movement of his company when his clown left in 1599 and a new clown arrived, or the change of monarch or whatever. Then you start more and more to try and divine the man from the works and ascribe biography from fiction, essentially. And as soon as you do that, that's when you get the conspiracy theories, because you can divine so many different types of men from those works. And people started to say, oh, you know, Shakespeare is Hamlet. Oh, no, no, Shakespeare is Prospero. Oh, no, no, Shakespeare is Jakes, in As You Like It. And then you suddenly, well, he can't be all of these people, so, and we don't like the fact that he didn't have a university education, so he must have been someone else. And so there's you've got a man who somehow gained this universal appeal because of his universal understanding of humanity, his radical approach to theatre and writing. Once those things had become more fully appreciated, a fascination with the question marks, with the blank spaces in his life that were desperate to fill. And now you're suddenly taking a man and turning him into a legend, into a genius, into someone whose works have been propelled into the higher ranks of literature with a capital L, that he is known now as being a poet and a man of literature rather than a playwright and a man of the theatre. And, you know, suddenly he's the man of the millennium. But it all stems from this, you know, hitherto unseen and since unseen ability to tap into the human heart, the human mind, and the human condition, which allows everybody all over the world to say Shakespeare is ours.
My final clip today is from Professor Stanley Wells, and Stanley has been seeing Shakespeare's plays for 60 years or so, and he can summarise perfectly for us why we never tire of seeing the same play over and over and over again.
Shakespeare's more famous now than most of the other, than all the other writers of his time, it's fair to say. Some of them are highly regarded by people who take a specialised interest in literature and in drama. People like Christopher Marlowe, author of Dr. Faustus, for example, or Ben Jonson, author of great comedies like Volpone and so on. Their plays are valued, but Shakespeare is valued much more than any of his contemporaries for a number of reasons. One is that he wrote more plays than most of them. Another is that most of the plays that he wrote are good plays, successful plays. Another is that they are varied plays, that he writes light comedies like The Two Gentlemen of Verona, profound tragedies like King Lear, fascinating histories about politics of the past, which relate to the politics of his own time quite strongly too. These are some of the reasons why Shakespeare remains popular. But fundamentally, I think, Shakespeare has outstripped his contemporaries because he is such a profound writer, because his plays give us a greater sense of the value of human life, of how people live, of how people love, of the importance of human relationships than any other writers of his time or of any other time. Shakespeare's plays are as popular as they are because he was perhaps the greatest writer who has ever lived. It's partly because he was writing plays, which go on being performed, and therefore which can be brought freshly to life for each generation by actors of the present. In other words, he's not simply a bookish writer, like some other great writers of the past, like John Milton, for example, or Alexander Pope, who are great writers, but you've got to sit down with a book and read them. With Shakespeare, you can get the full Shakespearean experience. You can only, indeed, get the full Shakespearean experience by seeing his plays acted. Preferably, I think, in the theatre, but also in the cinema, and every time the plays are acted, they become slightly different, of course, because each time there is an interaction, a necessary interaction, between the text, between what the actors are saying, and between the personalities and the skills of the actors themselves. And this is one of the reasons why one can go on seeing Shakespeare's plays with great pleasure and fascination over many decades. I've been seeing Shakespeare's plays for 60 years or more, and I can still go and see Much Ado About Nothing or Hamlet or King Lear with expectation not only of pleasure, but of having a somewhat different experience from the last time I saw that particular play, because of the different styles in which it's performed, the different personalities of the actors who are performing these great roles. Each time the plays are performed, they take on new resonances with life at the time they are being performed. They've been used sometimes for political purposes. In Soviet Russia, for example, they became used often as an expression of dissidence from the current regime. Hamlet could be seen as a protester against the state. When Hamlet was performed in Romania during the regime of the dictator Ceausescu, Claudius, the villain of the play, was actually played as Ceausescu, and Gertrude, his wife, as Madame Ceausescu, as a way of pointing political parallels with the time in which the play was being performed. That's just one example of the way that the plays can take on new resonances but in relation to the society prevailing at the time that they're being performed.
Well, that's the end of this episode, and it's the end of the series. Thank you to today's speakers, Paul, Stanley, Ben, Michael and Liz, and to everyone who's spoken to me throughout this series. Thanks to the Friends of the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust, as always, for making this podcast possible, and thank you to you for joining me for the last 10 weeks for a whistle-stop tour of some of the frequently asked questions about Shakespeare's life. If you've missed any episodes, our back catalogue is on iTunes and Audioboom, and don't forget to head over to our blog, findingshakespeare.co.uk, to read the show notes. If you want to get in touch or have any suggestions for future podcasts, you can tweet us at Shakespeare Birthplace Trust or using the hashtag #TalkShakespeare.